And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Warrior Edition. This is Doug Rocky, and how is everybody doing tonight? I hope everybody is doing well. Well, we got Christmas is rolling on down. But as we roll into Christmas, we got obviously a lot of things we have to consider. And on Warrior Connection, we continue to provide information, education, and try to establish and develop policy, which is important. What I'd like to begin tonight, and we're going to work on this for a few weeks, is the whole idea of education and training for all our military personnel. What happens once they complete their military duties and they re-enter the civilian life? Are they prepared to get a job? Do they have adequate education? What do they have? What do they need? Some of the things we need to look at as we do this, obviously, is how are we going to create millions of jobs? What veteran-specific education and training policies and funding are essential? How do we ensure veterans have the academic and vocational qualifications for long-term permanent employment? Are they physiologically and psychologically capable? Again, that goes back to what we've talked about a lot on the show, is ensuring they have the proper medical care in all areas. And then are they in the right location and availability for jobs? So a whole host of different things we'd like to look at. My guests tonight are just, I mean, really neat. We got Mike Eisenscher, and Mike has got about 50 years of experience, ladies and gentlemen, and looking at policy as far as with unions and education and training, public policy and everything. We also have Mary Laddie from Military Family Speak Out, and hopefully Patricia Axelrod has also joined us, who's been essential in getting our guest.
Hello, friend. How are you tonight?
Great. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little, when I read your information, what you've been involved in, as we've communicated by email, wow. Talk about an individual that has an idea and a concept of what's necessary for good public policy as far as jobs for our vets. How do we look at taxing policies? How do we look at everything? Can you give us some background, Mike? And Mary, also jump in there along with Mike.
I think Denise is also on board here, isn't she? Denise,
yes,
are you on board?
Yes, I am.
Hey, wow, great. Ladies and gentlemen, this is another one of our things. Major Denise Nichols, retired U.S. Air Force and combat nurse. We've worked together many years. Denise has been essential in working with all the veterans for many, many years in establishing policies in Washington, D.C. with both the Department of Defense and the VA. We got quite a crew here to begin this discussion. Mike, you're on the air. Let's help us.
Well, my background is in the labor movement. I've spent most of the last 40 years in one way or another working for unions or active in unions. And about 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, I was involved in founding U.S. Labor Against the War. In January of 2003, just prior to the invasion, with the idea that we would mobilize inside the labor movement in opposition to the impending military attack on Iraq. Well, we didn't stop it, but we did found an organization that continues to this day, and we have about 190-plus affiliated labor unions, labor councils, various kinds of labor organizations, and have quite an extensive program of activities in the labor movement and in the anti-war movement. Our latest project is something called the Jobs, Not Wars Petition. And we have now 108 organizations working on this petition campaign across the country, both inside and outside of the labor movement and the anti-war movement. We have civil rights groups, peace groups, faith organizations, economic justice groups, quite a wide array.
Mary, where does the Military Family Speak Out come in on all of this?
Well, Military Families Speak Out works with United for Peace and Justice and also with Michael's group on a regular basis at meetings we have every 2 weeks. And this is where Michael brought this idea to us. And really how MFSO fits into this is that we wanted a way to work with others to obtain our goals and the goals that are common among so many of the groups that have joined our coalition. You know, MFSO, Military Families Speak Out, needed a louder voice to affect change. You know, it's so very hard to be heard when you are a minority, and Military Families Speak Out are a minority. And so, you know, we are very concerned with so many issues that affect people in America. And also we're concerned that there'll be the money available for our vets. You know, it's estimated that over the next 40 years, it's going to cost $60 billion to $1 trillion to care for all our veterans. And we want to be sure that money is there. We have to start looking for ways that we take care of our vets and for all of Americans.
Mary, briefly, your goal with Military Families Speak Out, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm right here. Your goal is to end these wars in Iraq and also in Afghanistan, and although ostensibly we've ended the war in Iraq, we in the know that there are thousands of contractors still over there. And your own son is due for redeployment as well into Afghanistan, isn't it?
Yes.
And your goal in Military Families Speak Out is to speak out against these wars, to end these wars, and to divert spending from war into peacetime needs. Is that right?
Absolutely. Our main focus is ending the war. First of all, we tried to prevent the war in Iraq. Then we were against the war and the Afghanistan war, and we tried to prevent any other wars they may have on their horizon, like Iran. We're very certain that, you know, our soldiers should not be sent into war, you know, without the facts, without the truth, unless it's absolutely necessary. No more wars that we go into because of all this fear-mongering. It get us into two disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, not knowing the truth and the details. And we just can't do that to our men and women who so bravely serve for us and in our name. And so that's a major concern. And, of course, we also want military people of America to hear the stories of military families so that they know what we face each day. And I think if people knew those things, they would maybe demand, you know, everybody says they're against the war, but there is no big demand to end the war, and that is our daily effort.
I think that's, you know, this is all very critical because, you know, we've got to do this because, as we've talked about before on the show and personal experience and everything else, again, we've got involved in so many of these wars and battles that I've been involved in personally without any real justification. But the consequences thereafter are what's disastrous. And this, I think, you know, what the focus has got to be, because as the individuals get out, and Mary, you've been very essential, Denise, you're essential in it, Patricia, all of us have been essential in trying to get medical care for everybody, both the physiological and the psychological medical care is essential. But as we remember, once these guys get discharged, to have any self-worth, self-being, they have to have a job. Now, throughout history in the United States, and Michael, you're an expert on this, the labor unions have been the one that has provided overall the predominant skilled labor and semi-skilled labor for our nation to sustain its growth, haven't they?
Well, at one time, unions represented about one-third of the workforce, 35%. But that was back in 1954, and it has been going down ever since. Today, on average, it's about 11% for the whole country, but in the private sector down about 7%. So it's a smaller and smaller portion of the workforce. But you're correct that unions have historically provided training programs, apprenticeship programs in the construction trades in particular, that have prepared people for the labor market, that have given them the skills they need and certifications that employers recognize. As the labor movement gets weaker, those services become harder to find. And, you know, the problem of employment for veterans is really a subset of a bigger problem, which is employment for everybody. The reality is that we have outrageous unemployment in this country. Officially, it's around 8%, but in reality, if you go into most inner cities, it can run as high as 50%. And that doesn't include the people who are marginally employed or employed part-time. They need full-time work, or they're employed casually, you know, week to week. This is no way to run an economy. And what we're saying is that we've got our priorities all backwards.
Amen.
Real national security has got to include economic and social security. Economic and social security is critical for the health of the nation. Otherwise, what are we defending? Are we going to defend a bunch of paupers?
Michael, what you're saying is making a lot of sense. How can we develop the economic security again? We're looking at education and training. One thing that you and I have discussed offline already is the sheer dearth of vocational training for the skilled trades, which are essential for everyday life, because high schools have stopped doing that. We don't have that many colleges or junior colleges or trade schools doing that as we need for everybody that's coming around, because only a fraction of people really need to go to college, and even those that go to college, they have to select the major they're going to be able to get a job in. And as you said before in our communications, too many of those people end up working at, you know, Walmart or McDonald's or something like this. So what kind of policy recommendations from your 50 years of experience and working with everybody could you put forth or recommend that we need to adopt or consider?
Well, let's start with some immediate needs. We have two regions of our country that have been devastated by natural disasters, the Gulf region and the Northeast. There is enough construction work to be done in rebuilding the housing and the factories and the commercial districts and the infrastructure of these regions to put lots of people to work. So there's an opportunity there, if our country is committed to doing it, to rebuild, and to rebuild by putting people to work.
Well, where do we
that
get
means
the money
training
for this,
them
Mike?
For that work
where
so that
the
they have the skills
this,
required to do the work.
Where do we get the money for this, Mike? The fact is, of course, we need folks in New Orleans. We need folks all over. We could rebuild our roads, our bridges. But where do we get the money for this? That's the question, of course. And as an aside, let me just interject something. As you know, the unemployment for veterans is higher than for civilians. And for women veterans, mm-hmm. the percentage of post 9/11 female vets is actually up to 19.9%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Mm-hmm.
That's rather stunning.
It is.
19.9% of women who have served are unemployed.
And these are women in the prime of their economic earning life.
Yes.
This is the time when they should be productively employed.
Yes.
Do we have individuals that have, you know, for what you're suggesting, Michael, to me it makes complete sense. Do we have the individuals who are coming out of the military that have the prerequisites necessary such that the labor unions or somebody, and I guess labor unions is one have all the experience, could put forth a giant training and education program to prepare individuals or do on-the-job training or whatever to get them involved to do what you're suggesting?
Well, that gets us back to the issue of resources, because somebody has to pay for that training. And, you know, historically, in the construction trades, both the employers and the employees contributed a certain number of pennies per hour into a training fund, and that was what supported the apprenticeship system. But as union labor is getting smaller and smaller and employers become stingier, it's much harder to raise those kind of funds. So you ask the question, where is the money going to come from? Well, one place it can come from is a bloated, wasteful, and fraud-prone military contracting system.
That Eisenhower warned us about, what?
That's exactly right.
How many years ago? 60 years ago?
It was 1953, I believe, when he made his speech. It was his final speech before leaving office, and he warned the American people about the dangers of a runaway military-industrial complex. And that's exactly what we have today. We're spending over $700 billion a year, not including the cost of the wars.
And let me interject something. As to put that in perspective, this program will be 60 minutes. At the end of 60 minutes, we will have spent more than $1 million per minute. So we will have spent more than $60 million just in the course of this program.
That's right.
Can I
we spend
something here?
Oh, please.
In all of the world, we spend 42% of all of the military spending in the entire world. We spend more than the next 14 countries combined, which includes Russia and China and England and France, every conceivable enemy. If we were to cut our military budget in half, we'd still be spending more than any other country in the world.
Mm-hmm. And we spend about a quarter of our gross national product or GDP on military, and only about 3% or so on education. So where are we going? What is this all about, Mike? And Joyce, you wanted to say something? Or
Denise. Listen, I could use everybody's support, and this doesn't relate to employment, but our ill Gulf War veterans from 1991, we have a petition going, and I think it's appropriate that y'all all write down this little website so you can support us. But we bounce this around. We've had petitions before, but we went to the petitions.whitehouse.gov, and there's a petition there to support 1991 Gulf War vets who are suffering from a multitude of illnesses. And we would like everybody to support us, sign on to that, pass the word to your labor unions, to other people. It's on petitions.whitehouse.gov to support 1991 Gulf War veterans who are suffering from a multitude of illnesses. And we have to get like 25,000 signatures to hit the mark for attention at the White House.
Remind us again, Denise, as the program winds down. Remind us again and give us that place where we can sign on. But going on with our travails here and the fact that there's just not enough money in our budget to train the people that we need to. And I might add, people are talking about, of course, the budget cuts. And as we discuss this and the reality of the proposed budget, it should be known that we have shrunk our non-defense discretionary spending to a level lower or equal to that which we expended in 1962. So what more can we cut?
Well, that's the whole point of our Jobs Not War campaign, is there's a big ocean of money that we can take that is being used irresponsibly. You know, the Pentagon hasn't been audited in 20 years. What other federal agency gets away with that? I mean, there are billions and billions of dollars there that are being wasted, and they have this year a $100 billion surplus in their account that has not been spent. There is plenty of money in this country if we take it and reprioritize how we want to spend it. What is it that we value? Do we truly value spending 57% of our discretionary dollars on war and preparation for war? I don't think so. I think the people in America made it perfectly clear that we want out of the war, that we want to cut Pentagon spending in a major way. I mean, it has been studied, and we could cut nearly $100 billion a year for 10 years for almost $1 trillion and not affect the safety of America. That's how much wasteful spending is there. You know, we've done a lot in the past 10 years to kind of bring the military up to snuff, and we've done that. You no longer need to keep pouring so much money in that regard, because we are now have a very fine military system. And so really, it is our priorities, and we need to start focusing on jobs and people and veterans. If we want to really take care of people, the money has to come from somewhere, and that's where it's at. That's the ocean. It's not in domestic spending. You can't cut much more there. It is in defense spending.
Michael, is there anybody in Washington, D.C. or in local legislatures that are listening to what your message is and the recommendations?
Yes, there is. In Congress today, there is something called the Progressive Caucus, which actually is going to get bigger with the incoming freshman members of Congress, because a number of progressive members were elected to replace more conservative ones. The caucus is still a minority caucus in terms of the overall Congress, but its influence is growing. And every year it puts out a progressive people's budget, is what they call it. And that budget talks about the realistic ways in which we could spend money to provide health care for everybody in the country who needs it, education for our children, security for our seniors, help for the disabled and for veterans and for people with various kinds of disabling diseases. All of that is possible if we spend our money properly. And that doesn't mean weakening our defense. You know, Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. And he made a comment recently. He said, you know, we're building weapons that don't work for use against enemies that don't exist.
Amen on that one. I've been involved in that.
You know, the arms manufacturers have a powerful lobby. They give a lot of money to the members of Congress every year. And they are basically purchasing contracts with that money that allow them to continue making cost-plus profits, where they are guaranteed to earn a profit no matter how much they squander, and often producing shoddy goods, producing things that don't work, producing weapons. I'll give you an example. They're talking about a second engine for a jet that's in development, which has an engine that works perfectly well, but now they want a contract with a separate company in order to produce the same engine for that jet. Now, that's just, you know, in private business, if that were the way businesses operated, they would go bankrupt. We cannot continue to operate that way as a nation.
Let's talk about some of the obstacles to employment for veterans. Doug, I know you have very firm ideas on this.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm looking at, again, from Denise's, if you're still there, Denise and I have had a lot of experience with this. The main problem we're running into right now is a physiological condition, the medical problems. We have incredible medical problems with the veterans going back to Vietnam and all the way, especially in the Desert Storm 90 and 91, and we're seeing the same medical problems, astronomical. We're looking at 60 to 70% of the force having serious physiological medical problems. This covers a whole range from muscular, skeletal, to respiratory, cardiac, and everything else. Denise came up with a lot of things. We're seeing incredible cardiac problems on very, very young kids and all the neuromuscular problems. That limits employment capabilities when they have incredible neuromuscular problems, skeletal problems. The psychological effects of war. I mean, you can get around that, and we've all worked around that, but again, you have to have proper care and treatment and understanding, and it's as much an individual spiritual regrowth as it is as an outside regrowth. We also have academic qualifications. The one thing we've talked about and we've noticed before, and we've got the literature and the data is out there, as the military went into all these wars, the individuals that they were recruiting and bringing into the military had very limited academic and vocational qualifications before they came in the military. And so now once they get outside of the military, the old adage where the military prepared you to do a job, well, those days are gone. It's completely history. You have to get the specialized training. Well, now we run into a problem. Do they have the qualifications? And, Michael, this is where you're a true expert on. Do they have the qualifications, or could they be provided the qualifications to get into what you call the union apprenticeship program or the skilled trades programs?
If the jobs were there, Michael.
That's right. Yeah, that's part of the problem. You can only train people if they have jobs to go to. Otherwise, nobody's going to pay for that kind of training. So we've got to create an economy that generates those jobs, and we're not doing it now.
And we sure do need it, don't we? The infrastructure is deteriorating rapidly.
That's right. I mean, you know, we've got bridges that are in danger of falling down, roads that need repairing, schools that are too old and outmoded. You name it. We've got plenty of work that needs to be done. Inner cities that housing needs to be rehabilitated. And this is all separate from the destruction, of the hurricanes. I mean, this is the routine wear and tear on a society. And we're not producing the skilled labor for the future. We are giving away our manufacturing capacity, our ability to make things. And that's what this country was always known for. Our ability to make things and to make things happen. Those skills are being developed somewhere else. They're being developed in Asia, in Latin America, but they're not being developed here. We're letting our school systems rot, where only the very privileged are getting really high-quality education, and everybody else, your kids are sitting there with 30 in a classroom, teachers who are overworked and underpaid. You know, this is the problem. And we've got to address it. And we're only going to address it when the American people say we've had enough. We're going to demand this of our members of Congress. And if they don't do what we want them to do, we're going to replace them.
Now, one of the things, again, here, and this is, I mean, in the United States, all over in our area, education is a local issue, okay? It comes from a local tax base, some limited funding from the state level and very, very little from the federal level.
Mike worked with the teachers' union. Am I right, Mike?
I'm sorry, say that again?
You worked with the teachers' union, correct?
Yeah, I was a staff person for the California Federation of Teachers for a few years.
Mm-hmm. You're a teacher yourself, aren't you, Mike, a professor?
I teach part-time in the labor studies program at community college here, Laney College in Oakland, and I teach political economy, so I meet lots of people both inside and outside the labor movement who are trying to get a course that meets the economics requirement, and the course does qualify, so it's not just labor people who come there.
Yeah.
And it's terrible. You know, in the first day of class, I always do an exercise. I ask the students, I say, I'd like you to imagine what a good economy looks like. And we start putting things up on the board, you know, and they say, well, we need a secure job, we need health care, we need education for our kids, you know, good retirement, all the things that people think of when they think of a good economy. And we get through with the exercise, and I say, well, wait a minute, there's something missing. And people are scratching their heads and can't think of another thing. I said, nobody put down, we need a bigger military, more prisons, and more police. Nobody ever does that. I've taught this course now 6 years, and they've never, ever raised that question. People don't think of that as a good economy, and they're right.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's no foundation. The other thing, too, that we have to look at, and again, this comes back into the union work and everything else, and Denise, you're an expert in this because of your total medical background, certification and license requirements. A lot of jobs today require a state license or certification. There's been a move, and I know I was involved in it 30-odd years ago when the combat medicine area where we were doing it 30 years ago, we required all the combat medics that finished it to make sure they had the academic and vocational qualifications and then sit and pass their national registry as an emergency medical technician or the state registry, Illinois, Wisconsin. We were doing it wherever we were at. How do certification and license requirements come in today, Michael? Where are that at? The military is talking about making some of their classes, you know, appropriate, but again, from my experience, while they have some, they're so low on the total totem pole in comparison to what happens in the courses that would the individual have problems with certification and license requirements? Michael and then Denise, both of you.
This is not an area in which I am an expert, so I'm offering a layman's opinion. Many of the courses that people take in order to qualify for the jobs in the military that are required are highly specialized and don't necessarily have the kind of transferable skills that you would need out in regular employment. So they need some kind of supplemental education in order to meet those qualifications. Many employers do look for certifications depending on the type of work. I know in the construction trades, for example, you need to be licensed to do certain kinds of work. I talk to, for example, plumbers who work in the Silicon Valley. There are various levels of licensing that they go through in order to work in building these high-tech factories that have to meet very, very high standards of technical standards. Well, that training doesn't come from no place. It's got to come from the apprenticeship programs. And so that's where the investment goes. But if we're not building those factories because those factories are going overseas, then those jobs don't exist.
I might add that... Denise, forgive me, but let me just add this as well. Unfortunately, or contributing to the problem coming up in 2012, will be the failure to reauthorize legislation that President Obama signed into law. and that was the Returning Heroes and Wounded Warrior tax credits. And the Returning Hero tax credit provided incentives up to $5,600 for hiring unemployed veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wounded Veterans Warriors tax credit provided incentives for up to $9,600. And unfortunately, these have not been reauthorized in light of the extraordinary physical problems. Who's to say that they will be reauthorized? And in addition to that, several states also offer incentive programs, California and Vermont amongst them, but those two are disappearing.
And I think that's what our whole campaign is about, is there are so many valid issues that we've talked about right here that need to be addressed. And our petition, the Jobs Not Wars petition, specifically addresses that, and it also is a reflection of the demands of what the majority of Americans want. And just briefly, the petition, how do we do this? How do we take care of what we need to take care of? And what we say is we need to end the war in Afghanistan now. We want to create good-paying jobs. We want to let the Bush tax cuts expire for the top 2%. We feel that the wealthiest and corporations must do their fair share and pay a little more. It also talks about protecting the social safety net, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and investing in meeting the challenge of climate change, which affects all of us. And also, the biggest thing is make substantial cuts to the out-of-control Pentagon budget. And also, instead of war, relying on negotiation and determined diplomacy rather than military power. That is the focus of our petition and a way of creating money to take care of all the issues we just talked about, because unless we have the money, we will never be able to address all of these problems. And there is a way to get that. And this is the beginning of letting Congress and our president know that we've had enough. They need to listen to the American people and start making these changes now.
And that that petition is Jobs Not War. Why don't you tell our listeners, Mary, where they can find that petition?
Okay, it's at www.jobs-not-wars.org. And you can see all the 100-plus organizations that have joined our cause. You can sign the petition, and, you know, we'd love people to spread it far and wide, you know, use social media, send it to your own networks. We've already gotten a great response in about 2 weeks, and we'll be sending our results to Congress and the President around the inauguration time.
Well, I'm pleased to say that I've signed up, so I pray that our listeners will sign up as well.
Denise, what type of physiological impairment barriers do you see for employment? I mean, you've been working in this field for many, many years. What is your feeling, and how does that all come in there?
Well, my concern is we should also address other technological jobs like call centers, getting the vets employed at call centers. They can work out of their home, take breaks, whatever. But what we're seeing on the Gulf War illness, which is, you know, also civilians with chronic fatigue. We have the memory problems, the neurocognitive problems, the irritability at times, so they have to be allowed to take breaks. The chronic fatigue is that's a kind of mixed nomer. It's just terrible exhaustion after even trying to carry on your normal activities that a normal person would do that would lay up a gut for vet for days or weeks.
And we're talking about very young people
in their 40s now were our youngest on Gulf War.
And then we're seeing it amongst all the new kids coming back too, aren't we?
And yes, and the fibromyalgia where you have pains and you got to get up every once in a while and kind of move around and, deal with the pains that are throughout the body, the peripheral neuropathy that we're seeing. So there are significant impediments, and that's why one thing is we've got to be sure, what I'm saying today is we've got to be sure to push to take care of this group of vets that have fought for 2 decades now and still not getting their compensation through the VA, much less Social Security disability. and their families are falling apart. They don't have money to buy food or gifts for Christmas, so they cannot contribute even to the economy because they're so sick. The VA physicians have not been educated by the leading researchers like Dr. Haley, Dr. Klimas, Dr. Galam, Dr. Leah Still, the ones that truly know what's going on with the Gulf War vets and been fighting alongside of us for 20-something years. So the VA doctors haven't been trained. The VA rating officials really do not get it either. The VA has failed this group of veterans with Gulf War illness, whether from 1991 or the ones non-deployed, they got vaccines, got sick. So we have to have that number one on our agenda, and I hope the labor unions will get involved and help push that. We need more people involved.
Denise, let me ask you a question. I don't hear a whole lot said about traumatic brain injury, yet I'm aware that lots of vets are coming back with undiagnosed symptoms of traumatic brain injury. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the traumatic brain injuries are very much like some of the neurological things that we're seeing with Gulf War veterans, but the memory problems, neurocognitive, being able to function, go back to school. You know, they need assistance. They need, iPads to put things on and have a technique to, keep up with things even at home with their medicines. I mean, that's very complex.
It's like a post-concussion syndrome, though, Mike.
Yeah, or a post-encephalitis symptom.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than concussion on the traumatic brain injuries.
And we're seeing also, just because of personal side effects, we have knowledge of, you not only have a traumatic brain injury, but you have all the neuromuscular, all the spinal, the entire spinal column is affected.
Yeah, we have spinal degenerative problems happening, the fusion having to go on with the spinal column. We have, for whatever reason, it seems like we lose calcium, and that gets to the bones, and then we have easy fractures. We have that kind of problem. So,
you know, Vietnam vets fought for years
to get
recognition of the effects of exposure to Agent Orange.
We're still doing that.
And, you know, that fight still goes on. And I think we're going to have a new epidemic of vets who were exposed to depleted uranium weapons.
Well, when we talk about Gulf War illness.
And what's going to happen, as they come back and in 5, 10, 15 years, the cancers that develop and other problems.
To put it bluntly, I was up at a Gulf War when we have a research advisory committee meeting, and it was when we were still getting our Gulf War Veterans Information System data management at VA was putting out a quarterly report of how many claims went in, how many were approved, blah, blah, blah. They also had the list of how many had died. When 3 months went through, and the next report we got, and I was up there and I grabbed one of the newest ones that I hadn't gotten mailed to me, and I compared it with the old one. When I saw that we had 1,000 deaths in 3 months from the Gulf War vets, does that wake you up? 1,000 in a three-month period. And I don't even know if that number was accurate from the
Sadly, day. They're reaching the age now where these toxins which store in the brain and in the fat cells and in the liver are recirculating and reactivating.
Right, and when we may have had them as young as 18, if their parents signed for them to go in, so they may have been 18 or 19, we're 20-something years out, so they're in their late 40s.
Yeah.
Some of them are 39, 40, 41, 42, and every day I'm picking up obits of these in their 40s that are dying. This is abnormal. There's no way to make sense of this, and they're dying without help.
We work extensively with unions in Iraq, a fledgling labor movement that's trying to establish itself there, and we're getting reports back of horrific birth defects of children whose parents were exposed to depleted uranium and various other chemicals that were used in the invasion and subsequent fighting. factory workers who go back to work in places that had been attacked at one time or another and are being exposed to the dust and other compounds that are in the air and suffering terrific cancers and various other kinds of diseases.
Yeah.
And if it's happening there, it's going to have to happen here. So I'm wondering, for example, to what extent there's been any studies of the effects on the children of veterans
of the genetic disorders. Yeah, I've got two quick items here. Anything out of Iraq, we need documented. We need doctors over there and researchers getting their publications done, because I know that is happening too. But there's nothing scientific in the scientific medical journals to back up what we're saying. So we need them over in Iraq.
Well, you know,
they tore up their system over there with all the bombing, but they should be getting to the point that they can do studies and document that. We have tried to document since the early 90s the Gulf War veterans' problems with children, loss of fetuses for the female veterans, for the loss of children that we get to birth and then they die, or the ones that are born with all kinds of defects and plus mental issues being autism and other learning disorders. There is an Association of Birth Defect Children that worked with the Vietnam vets on that. They have worked with the Gulf War vets, and I'm sure they're branching out to the OIF, OEF, and onward. But we have been dwarfed, and you need to hear this. If we cannot even get our veterans of the Gulf War 991 through the compensation system and get our illnesses acknowledged, then we can't even work on the children and the spouses that are getting sick.
The thing that came out in the Army Times report again the other day is over 60% of all claims processed by the VA are in fault and in error. In other words, they're not providing the medical care necessary by awarding service connection. This, again, was a big report in the Army Times, just came out, but we've been seeing these problems continuously. So we're looking at well over 50% of Desert Storm, incredible high percentage of Vietnam vets. We're looking at 60% for OIF, OEF, OND vets. So we have all these medical problems, and then so many of these individuals were brought in the military without the proper education and training necessary to even complete the military training really well, much less once they get out of the military, what happens. You know, Michael, as you talk about an entire philosophical change, a cultural change, it sounds like what you're suggesting is the key to doing this. But,
and Michael and everybody that's listening, Dr. Haley put out one study right at Thanksgiving time, and that was on the Archives of Neurology, which is connected with the Journal of American Medical Association. We also just lately, this past week, had articles from USA Today and Stripes Magazine. If you put in Gulf War illness on a Google search, you'll find those. But they published in neuroepidemiology. And there's two portions to it. There's an epidemiology study and a mediology study. Now, what is different about this? Well, we all knew about the bunkers, being Comacia and others, and the studies on that. But what Jim Tuitt was a writer on one of these, and Tuitt and Haley put their brains together and have done the epidemiological study on the air war and downwind hazards that covered everything and how it connects, you know, with the information that Jim Tuitt had back in 1994 on the Regal Report and the air war and the alarms going off all over theater. And Haley's work with the neurological damage. So I'll recommend you, if you go and look up on neuroepidemiology, those are two new published studies this week. And that information, you need to go in and read the actual article, much less the news articles on it from USA Today, Kelly Kennedy, Stripes Magazine, Stripes Newspaper, I guess. This is breaking news over the past month. Now, Haley was brought into this, I want people to know, by Ross Perot, and a group of Navy Seabees met with Ross Perot back in 94-95 time period, Ross Perot, being a Naval Academy graduate, Navy officer, believed the troops. He flexed his muscle as much as he could with the University of Texas Southwest, and Haley started working on it. He didn't believe us. I've known him for years, and he didn't believe it until he was called into the chancellor's office and told, you will, you know, do a study on these Navy Seabees. He has been after the gold standard on the neurological diagnosis that needs to be made. It's not the full picture, but it's a big part of it.
Well, you know what,
now,
Denise?
Let me finish real quick. What happened was we had a VA collaborative center with UT Southwest, and as he finished the work with the Seabees and was getting the right neurological studies, brought the Seabees back in for a 10-year follow-up, ran them through for 7 days from morning to late at night, doing every study possible to find out which would be the best studies for the neurological testing. He did that. Then we were ready to branch out and pull up vets from other units, being Air Force, Army, Special Ops, the whole gamut. We had 15,000. We had 15,000 names. They were going to branch out to other groups. That's when their funding was stopped over, a BS type situation with consenting problem. They stopped his funds. Ross Perot stepped back in, provided funds again out of his own pocket. And Haley continued to work on this, and the studies I'm mentioning are hot off the press. It's Scientific Neurological Epidemiology magazine. And we need to pay attention to this. We need to help, because if we cannot get these GUF-4 vets, even through getting a service connection and a claim and the appropriate care, it's going to be the biggest black mark in the American military veteran history.
One thing that I remember, and Denise, you were there personally with us, we both got appointed to the Center for Disease Control for a major conference back in the end of February, early March 1999. And we there in Dr. Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath, and again some of the other ones you've already mentioned that were also present with us and got appointed too, came up with this incredible problem, what we call GUF-4 illness, which is an incredible response to extraordinarily healthy people that have now complex toxic exposures and horrific medical problems. An acute reaction is what Andres, if I remember this, Denise, he's saying this is what's happened through the better living through chemistry that started in the 60s. So what we're seeing in the Gulf War vets and now seeing in the current vets is the effects of toxic exposures that is symptomatic of exactly what we're seeing in the population as a whole.
You know, the World Health Organization reported this vis-a-vis Iraq as early as 1991. And when I was in Iraq in 91 and 92, I saw already on the ground, you could see the birth defects and you could see the children who were suffering and the people who were ill. But I think that it might be a good idea to come back to our Jobs Not War petition for just a minute. And Mary, if you're there, are you still there, Mary?
Yes, I'm here.
Mary, if you have a copy of that petition, could you read us that petition?
Well, the petition itself is, kind of a whole page. It's fairly long, and I did give you earlier, and I could do it again, kind of the synopsis of the petition. That's a little bit easier than reading the whole petition. Do you want me to do that again?
Yes, just give us an overview, and I think we've kind of established the fact that sadly those veterans who have been made ill as a consequence of their exposure to radioactive weaponry or chemical warfare or whatever it might be, those are the folks that need further assistance, and they need service-connected disability, many of whom have not yet even received that. But tell us now about your petition some more, dear.
Well, basically, we are looking for ways to fund things like the veterans and all the people in America who deserve better. You know, we're a very wealthy country, and we spend our money in ways that I don't think that most Americans agree with. So we have a petition that we think starts helping to solve this problem. We're asking to end the war in Afghanistan now, not in 2 years, but now, create good-paying jobs for our people, so they can educate their children and buy a home. You know, we want the Bush tax cuts to expire for the top 2%. We feel that the wealthiest and corporations must do their fair share and pay a little more. They've reaped all the benefits in these past 10, 12 years while everybody else is still struggling. We need to protect our social safety net, you know, not keep cutting from the domestic side. We need to cut from the defense side so that we maintain Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we take care of our people. That's what makes us proud to be Americans. We want to make substantial cuts in the Pentagon budget, which we discussed. I mean, that's billions and billions of dollars without hurting our security. And we want to rely on negotiation and determined diplomacy rather than military power. That is the beginning of starting the change that we need to see in our country. And that's what we're asking people to do, to go to www.jobs-not-wars.org and sign the petition and to forward it to anyone else that you know who might also feel the same way. We have 108 organizations. We're trying to get a large number, a big voice, so that we demand that Congress and the President do the will of the American people. We had an election. We said we don't want austerity. We don't want our benefits cut. You know, we paid for Social Security. We paid for Medicare. We don't want to come out now find we can't have those things. You know, we have the CEOs of Wall Street and the military corporations telling us now we have to lower our expectations, yet they haven't done anything. They're still charging us outrageous sums of money and making a fortune, and they're telling everybody else we have to sacrifice, but where is their sacrifice? It's all out of proportion, and that's the whole point. If we change our priorities, we have enough money to do the right things for our people and keep us safe.
Amen.
Mike, is there something we can do in the short term to help employ our veterans?
Well, if we were to begin investing in the, just take the hurricane damage and begin really rebuilding on a massive scale, which is what's required, there would be lots of work available. Lots of work. And it's not all skilled work either. There's a lot of general labor work that needs to be done. So the opportunities are there. It's a question of where do we put the priorities? I want to add one sort of a footnote to what Mary said. We hear from the politicians all the time about shared sacrifices, and I believe in that concept. What they don't say is that the American people, the 98% of us, have already made the sacrifices. It's time for the 2% to make theirs. They haven't made theirs yet. You know, we were told that if they got the tax cuts, that they would invest their money and that would create economic activity and more jobs. Well, they got the tax cuts, and we didn't get the jobs. They were creating jobs, all right, but they were creating them in China or for the Philippines or Korea. What about here? So it's time that people wake up and smell the coffee. You know, it's time for people to take democracy into their own hands and tell the members of Congress in their district what they want. And that's what the petition is designed to do. It's a statement to the Congress and the President. This is what the American people want.
Michael, in all your work with public policy and job work with the unions and everything, once and I'm asking you again something to reinforce what I believe I understand, but this is asking you, once an individual has a good job or mm-hmm. has a good income, the self-worth, the social, cultural problems that we are seeing, aren't they mitigated or reduced substantially all the way around?
I didn't hear that last part. Are they what?
Do they become less of a problem? In other words, once a person...
Well, you know, there are all kinds of studies that show how stress impacts people's behaviors. And there's nothing more stressful than unemployment and hunger. So probably next to combat, you know, those are the things that people will respond to. If you give people security, you give them a sense of self-worth, then things like drug abuse goes down, employment becomes more stable, people begin to function more in relationships. I mean, this is not rocket science. This is well established. The medical profession has studied this a lot. So we know what we need. The question is, do we have the will to make it happen?
Well, yeah, amen. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're running out of time. Michael, Mary, Denise, Patricia, we need to continue this conversation. We're going to continue next week again. We got another expert on getting vets jobs coming on next week.
We have a
Michael,
few minutes.
Can you come back at a later time and help us with this? And as you start getting your policies and your policy things put in place, we need to somehow get this out there to where get these policies actually changed.
Doug, we do have time for Mike and Mary to give us their contact information.
Yeah, please do,
man.
This has been critical. This is a good conversation. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Mary.
Michael, please give us some contact info.
Sure.
And Mary, please give us some contact.
If they want to, anyone wants to write to us, it's info, I-N-F-O, at jobs-not-wars.org. Info at jobs-not-wars.org.
Is that where they can
And that's Michael? Also the website is jobs-not-wars.org. And you can fill out the contact form either on the website or send us an email directly.
And Mary, give us some contact info.
Yes, we are working with the same organization, so that comfort information works for us, but also we have a general MFSO at MFSO.org.
And that's Mary, that's Military Families Speak Out.
Mm-hmm. And you guys are representing the people that are on the front lines right now, correct, Mary?
Pardon me?
You're the families representing the warriors, the soldiers that are on the front lines right now as we speak, correct?
Absolutely. And listening to that conversation just makes my headache because it's so sad how our veterans are being treated and all the challenges that we have. And we have to get the money and the programs to help them. It's our duty.
And remember, we've spent $60 million as we've spoken. Our government has spent $60 million on war as we've spoken.
And the petition site to sign on, and if everybody would write this down, www.petitions.whitehouse.gov/petition/support1991gov4veterans who are suffering multitude illnesses. Please take the effort to sign on and spread the word and get others to sign on.
We urge you to help our veterans listeners. We urge you to sign on to both of these petitions. Remember that a nation that invests all of its lifeblood, all of its monies in death is a dying nation. We are not a dying nation. We are a nation that deserves to live. Help us live.
Patricia, thanks for setting this up, getting Michael and Mary connected with us. I mean, this is an incredible gift. And Progressive Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen, Warrior Connection, we're providing information, education, and we're definitely moving forward. Ladies and gentlemen, God bless America. Michael, thank you. Mary, thank you. Denise, Patricia, thanks for all your work. Michael, I hope your efforts are successful. Mary, yours too.
Mm-hmm.